When it comes to getting attention, there are different ways to do that. One way is to shout, fight, fight, they're fighting, go look. Fighting gets attention. Well, you do have some information in Scripture about fights, and you see some of that in 1 Corinthians. Our text that we're going to begin with is 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10, and there was some contention, some strong division at Corinth. So maybe that was talked about by the individual members, maybe not. It certainly got Paul's attention. 1 Corinthians 1:10 says, "Now I beseech you, brethren, through the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that ye be perfected together in the same mind and in the same judgment." I mentioned to you in the last class that you find sometimes transition words. It is a way you find speakers doing that. Well, our next point is going to be, or now it's time to talk about. And sometimes people make smooth transitions, sometimes not so much. You find sometimes people saying something like, well, turning the corner, changing the conversation, and it is a radical change in conversation. You're talking about the weather, and now you're talking about, you know, who knows what, but it's a completely different subject. But it's nice if you can make a smooth transition. You can just kind of slide from this topic to that topic. And you see here a true mark as far as Paul making a distinction. He says, now, but. There's another subject that I want to introduce. And the conjunction that he uses offers a very strong contrast between all that thankfulness, all that gratitude that we saw in verses 1 through 9, and now one of the problems that was one of the core problems at the Corinthian congregation. There was division at the church at Corinth. It was bad, but as severe as it was, Paul still recognizes that that division could be healed. It had not yet reached the point where the people could not be brought back together. And we know that. I've mentioned this at different times, but I'll highlight it again for you. There are at least four different words, four different key words in the New Testament which talk about division or tearing. It's like rending a garment. It would be today, you have a piece of clothing that has been ripped. Well, if you say my shirt has been ripped, what does that mean?
Well, it's still in one piece. I mean, it's all there, but it's
got but maybe
damaged.
You really don't know, though, do you? If I say my shirt is ripped? I mean, there's some tear. We can acknowledge that much. But until we actually see it, or until it's described a little more fully, what do we know about the tear?
It could be large. It could be
small. All right. It might be small enough where we can repair it. A couple stitches in that, not a big deal. But if we've torn it 99% apart, then chances are it's going to be in the trash heap. So when we think about a tear, that is an image which we say we need a little information. We need to see how bad it is. So you do find in the New Testament there is a word which describes a disagreement, a strong disagreement. You see that word, for example, in Acts chapter 15 and verse 2, and people have that today. Sometimes you find non-Christians having disagreements, and there can also be Christians who have disagreements. You find husbands and wives, they may have some disagreements. Then you have another kind of disagreement. Let's think about marriage for just a little bit. Husband and wife, they don't see eye to eye on something, they discuss that, and they still can't come to terms. Can that escalate?
Yes.
Yes. And if it escalates, where does it perhaps go to as far as the next level? We've now moved from a disagreement, which is maybe a simple disagreement. We can't really come to terms as far as this item. Where does it go to then?
Separation.
All right. It's a more heated argument. It's
separation.
All right. Now you have a separation. You know, one storms out the door, one slams the door. You know, one says, you know, I'm going to, you know, cool off. I'm going to come back tomorrow. Those kinds of things. All right. Let's say that we've reached that second level, but it doesn't stop there. Let's say that we get to level number three with a husband and wife. What's level number three?
Counseling.
Well, possibly.
Could be a separation.
All right. And now we actually think as far as that tear, it's not a little. I mean, it's not significant. But now we're thinking the tear is big enough that we could kind of go either way, right? I mean, maybe it's repairable, maybe not. We're going to do our best to try it. But at this particular point, you have a severe tear. And that is the word that Paul uses to describe the division that we have here. It is that third sense. And then you have the fourth word, which if we put it in terms of marriage, what would that describe?
Divorce.
All right. We're through. There is no chance of reconciliation. There is no chance of coming together. We are actually going to separate. It's like tearing that garment in half, and it cannot be put back together. So the Corinthians, if you want to use the word divorce, they were not at the divorce stage. They were not saying, we hate you so much, we despise you so much. And you can see that because in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, what were they doing? Were they still coming together?
Yes.
Yes. Now, what was happening when they came together? All right, you got the rich. They apparently showed up first. They ate all the good food, and then the poor show up, and, well, hey, sorry, you know, nothing left. You know, a few beans over there, get a scoop of corn, and maybe a little meat, but that's all that there is. So it was a severe terror, but it had not reached the point where it could have. So things were serious. Things were bad. The word actually describes, in secular realm, secular literature, a plowing of the ground. And when you have that kind of thing in the church, you might compare that to cliques. You find that sometimes in the workplace. Anybody ever worked in a place where there were cliques? What's that like?
It depends if you're in it or out of it.
Yeah, I'm thinking out of it, so thanks for the clarification. Well, we'll look at it both ways. What does it mean to be out of the clique?
You get left out.
Okay, that's the good general answer. Specifically, what does that mean?
You're unpopular.
Oh, well, I'm going to start with Mom, and then Betty will take your...
Unpopular.
All right, you're not popular. You're shunned.
You're treated differently.
Yeah. I mean, hey, we're going out to lunch today. Oh, I'll go. Oh, we don't have room for you. Well, I already made the reservation for 6, and that would be 7. Well, they could probably squeeze in 7. They could call, but when they tell you that, you feel like you're about that tall. Anything else as far as cliques at work? Well, if they're going to cover for somebody and you're not in the clique, guess what?
You're out of luck.
You're out of luck. But if you're in the clique, what's true? Lunch invitation? You not only get invited, you get asked what?
To pay for it.
Well, that might be if you're out of the group.
Where do you want to go?
Huh?
Where do you want to go?
Yeah, where do you want to go? You know, what's your favorite spot? You pick, you choose. I'll drive. So there are definitely advantages, quote unquote, to being in a clique. And disadvantages to not being, but that's what was happening at Corinth. And that was a bad thing. And Paul says that has got to stop. He addresses these Christians as being brethren. So they needed to realize that they all had the same spiritual father. And then Paul, again, to point them in the direction, appeals to the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. We've seen the idea as far as the name of Jesus in a number of different passages. Thayer defined name as to beseech one by employing Christ's name as a motive or incentive. Another source said the name of Christ is an instrument of abonition, and Paul did not base that unity on himself. He didn't say, I, Paul, am asking this. I'm your friend. I'm your brother. I'm your teacher. I'm the guy who helped found the congregation. He's saying, look, the church is headed by who?
Christ.
Christ. Who sets the rules?
Christ.
Who do you need to obey?
Christ.
Christ. So, if I'm talking about unity, and I'm appealing to brethren, the brethren of Corinth, then guess what, folks? Get your house in order. Fix this problem. And if they fixed the problem as far as division, a lot of the other issues would have been fixed as well. Today, when people appeal to a name, you might have to think about this. I may not be able to make my question specific enough, unless they give away the answer. But how do people sometimes use a name when they make an appeal today? In the name of?
Jehovah.
No. Secular realm. People who are not religious.
In the name of law.
Well, that could be, if we're thinking about criminal activity, perhaps. In the name of what? How about decency? In the name of decency, we need to. In the name of? Anything else? How about humanity? In the name of common sense. People will appeal to different things in life to incentivize people, to motivate people to do different things, and sometimes they will. In the name of common sense, let's do this, or let's not do this. And people will say, well, okay, we agree with that. But if those things have any benefit, any authority, then certainly when we think about the name of Christ, that should be the authoritative source. We remember Colossians chapter 3 and verse 17, where Paul said, for whatsoever you do in word or in deed, do how much? Do all in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. So everything as far as a Christian life, it all stands under the name of Christ. Now, you would think that the Corinthians probably had some information about Jesus. And before the Lord goes to the cross in John chapter 17, Jesus has a fairly lengthy and a fairly marvelous prayer. Anybody remember the theme of that prayer? Yes. He prayed for unity. And I think that probably was one of the things that was talked about one of the things that was enjoyed by many Christians. Paul had surely talked about that and taught the Corinthians about unity, but for whatever reason, they had forgotten that. But Paul says, if you can get to that point where you have this unity, looking at the middle of verse 10, he says, what's going to happen? I want you to be able to speak what? I want you to be able to speak the same thing, and I want how many divisions among you? All right. How much of the congregation did Paul want speaking or saying the same thing?
All.
Not most, not nearly all, but he said, I want every single member to be in harmony. I want this to be a unified church. I will say a little bit more about this, but when you look at the denominational world, how important is the point that Paul makes to the people who are members of different religious groups?
Very.
Really? The denominational world, they want everybody to be unified? Yeah, they don't care. Anything goes. You have your way to God, you have your beliefs, you have your worship, you have your doctrines, and are you good or not? The prevailing view is yes. Now, not everybody believes that, but many do. Gary?
Well, that's how they redefine unity, is that everybody's accepting of everybody. Let's be unified together. Our theories could be any more different.
Yeah. And it's a common thing. It's one of the things that people have just become accustomed to, and they conclude that, well, that must be in the Bible, and when they come to verses like we find here, it just completely goes over the head. Brian?
You referenced 1 Corinthians 11. Verses 16 or 18 and 19 make it sound like division is a good thing and even admirable, or even required of us. I think that some denominational people point to chapter 11 and say that the division we've got, these are all good.
Yeah. There, I think, if you had someone make that claim, and there are people who do, I think we'd be well served to come back to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and say, let's see how the book begins. You also have, a little later, 1 Corinthians chapter 14, where Paul says God is not a God of chaos. He's a God of order. So there are a number of ways to show that that was not the point in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. But if you're going to be involved with division and you're called on to defend it, then that might be one of the passages that people use in an effort to do that. Anybody else? Tim?
Well, one of the things of a lot of people in the, not Church of Christ community, but the other churches, one of the things a lot of them always say is, we're all going to the same place, we're just going by different roads. You know, they say that, but they don't pay attention to verses like this.
Yeah. It's easy to hear things, and we just, for whatever reason, think, well, that sounds good, and we adopt that as part of our thinking, part of our philosophy, perhaps, and maybe we even accept that as truth. But when you start going back and looking at a lot of things, especially some ideas that people think are in the Bible, you begin to find a lot of the sayings which are so popular simply don't match up very well with Scripture. And that is one that's extremely common, but very, very wrong. Dolores?
I heard today on the radio where the Baptists, of course, they have their own boards and associations and whatever. And it's true that most of them are very accepting of everything. You know, anything goes. But this particular board got upset with the fact that two of their places of worship were not being accepting enough, and they cut them off and said, you have to be unified to us. Or not at all.
Yeah, it's interesting where people.
That was kind of, you know, unity to them within themselves is not the same as to their local governing board.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the lines that people draw. I don't know if you saw it or not, and I thought, well, I had to rethink this. Anybody see recently that there were some Mennonite groups that decided that they were going to accept same-sex marriages? Nobody saw that? Okay. There were, and I thought, well, that looks like an opportunity to reach out to some Mennonites. But then I thought about that for a couple minutes, and I thought, no, that is not correct. What would happen? If you're in that group, you're a Mennonite, and your group decides that they're going to accept same-sex marriages, and you are not supportive of that, 99 times out of 100, what will you do?
Form a new group.
Well, that could be. If you have enough people, you will perhaps form a new group, or...
Leave.
But yes, you'll leave, but you'll leave and go where?
Another Mennonite.
Yes. you're going to stay within the Mennonite faith because you've redrawn your line now. You would say, okay, they moved the line, so we're going to stay still on this side of the line. We'll just find somebody who's on this side of the line with us and shares our belief, shares our convictions. So we're going to speak the same thing, but we're going to speak the same thing by finding people who agree with us. So it's very, very interesting to see how people adjust. And it's contrary to what we find here. Is that it? Okay, let's look at what Paul says, sticking with that thought as far as speaking the same thing. Paul repeats that three times, and if you are involved with something else, I mean, look, when the Bible says this and there are other people who say that, that is a problem. You are not speaking the same thing. Now, he is not talking about denominations in this verse. We'll make that point again a little bit later. He's talking about a local congregation. But if it is wrong for a local congregation to have people who are speaking different things, and that's not in the area of opinion, that would be in the area of doctrine, that would be in the area of cliques, then that's certainly going to be wrong in any other way or form, and that certainly includes denominationalism. Remember the Old Testament Psalm, Psalm 133 and verse 1, behold how good it is for brethren to do what? To dwell in
peace.
Well, some translations might say peace.
Unity.
All right, there are at least some other versions which use the word unity. That is a good thing. It is good to be united. Anybody ever been in a neighborhood where there was disunity? A lack of unity in a neighborhood. Anybody ever had that?
I've heard about it.
What kind of neighborhood is that?
Chaotic.
I mean, all right. You know, what about the people who want trash pickup on Tuesday, the other people want it on Thursday? Now, you think that that's not a big deal, right? But for the people who want it on Thursday versus Tuesday, every week. Oh, man, trash came. Comes too early for me. Comes too late for me. People and, you know, opinions do enter into that, but again, that's not what we're talking about here. It is good for people to be united. In the Old Testament, I'm going to run this reference for you real quick, going back to the book of Jeremiah. We have some prophetical information as far as what the New Testament church was supposed to be like. And in Jeremiah chapter 32 and verse 39, we're not going to read anything before or anything after that. We've got a passage which talks about what God expected from the church. And I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me forever for the good of them and of their children after them. One heart and how many ways? Just one. Doesn't it sound a little bit like Ephesians chapter 4 verses 4 and 5? One faith and one Lord, one baptism, one hope, one God and Father of all. God has given one system. I am just puzzled. I mean, when you look at people, if you're looking at the quote-unquote Christian world as a non-Christian, and there have been a lot of people who have done this, and you see that there are 2,000 or so different denominations. What's your thinking?
Crazy.
Well, that might not be the word that comes to mind, but something similar. What comes to mind?
No one can know the truth.
Yeah, you're all different. I mean, if I'm looking at this sea of religions which all claim to follow Jesus Christ, and you're all different. I mean, you're saying you're right, and you're saying that you're right, and they're saying that they're right. How can we determine the truth? How can we determine if anybody's telling the truth? Well, what's the answer to that? Everybody may claim to follow the Bible, but what? I mean, can you imagine going to a mechanic? You got to have your fuel pump changed out. And, you know, maybe there are some similar steps as far as different vehicles, but let's say that you have 10 different manuals to change out a fuel pump. One was actually the manual for that vehicle for that year, but the other 9 manuals, they're from different manufacturers for different vehicles and different years. Now, they all deal with a fuel pump, right? All talk about how to change it out, how many hours involved, the labor, all that. But who in their right mind would say, well, all those other 9 manuals, you know, will tell us how to do the job and take care of everything? Nobody would think that way, would they? Who would say, if you want to change it out according to the manual, what do you need? You need the correct manual. You need it for this vehicle. You need it for this year. And if there are some other specifications, it has to match. And we understand that. But when it comes to the Bible, you know, everybody is not using the same manual, so to speak, even though there are claims. Anything you want to add or ask before we say a little bit more? Okay, let's go down and see what else we have here. In addition to that expression that Paul says, speak the same thing, we've got a second expression of unity, and that's found in what? That there be how many divisions among you? that there be no divisions among you. We don't want any at all. The word which is translated divisions is a schisma, S-C-H-I-S-M-A. And we can see, I think, the idea of a rent, a tear, and a piece of material there. That same word is used in Mark chapter 2 and verse 1, where Jesus talks about the tearing of the wineskins. We're also going to see that word a little later in this letter, 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 18, and 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 25. At this point in the letter, we've already seen the contrast that Paul introduces in 1 Corinthians 1:10. He says, but now, turning the page, but is he really torn into these Christians? I mean, has he just really cracked the whip? Or is he just kind of easing into it?
Easing.
All right, he has not really gotten after them yet. He is going to get a little more severe as the letter continues, but when you begin to think about this, he chooses his words very, very carefully. Suppose someone were to say to you, let there be no hate among you. Now, that's parallel to let there be no division among you, but let's think about the expression, let there be no hate among you. Now, if someone says that to you, how would you receive that statement? What would it mean to you? Let there be no hate among you.
I think I would be insulted that they would think that I would hate somebody.
All right, so you would conclude from that the person is saying you hate somebody. Is that correct?
Let there be
no hate. Wait. I'm going to get her on the hook. Is that what you're saying? Let there be no hate among you. Is that what you're saying, that in your mind that would be an affirmation of hate?
It would be an accusation.
An accusation of hate. Okay. All right. That's where Marcia is. Tim, to you.
I was going to say that there be no hard feelings.
Okay. Well, all right. We can use hard feelings if you want.
But don't let it come to blows or anything.
All right. So, again, you would take that to some degree as an accusation. Or at least there's a hint of a problem.
There's a problem.
Okay, so, all right. So, sounds like an accusation, sounds like a problem. Anybody else want to go on the record?
It'd be suspicious.
All right, well, now let's back it up a little bit more. So, we've got an accusation, it sounds like a problem, and now we're a little in the suspicious category. Anybody else want to take a more mild answer?
It's like, let there be no hate, let it be love.
All right, so if you want to really go to the other end of the spectrum, someone could say, I didn't perceive an accusation there. I heard that, and I was just thinking, this is what we want to do. Now, maybe if you are on the sensitive side, maybe there's something lurking in your life, you might understand that in a different way. Or maybe if you're more of the airhead kind of person, you just kind of, you know, thought, oh, there's nothing suspicious about that at all. And it just completely goes over the head. So it could be understood in multiple ways, depending on how it's said, depending on how we're perceiving that. So when Paul says this second expression, let there be no divisions among you, at least it seems like it raises the bar a little bit, especially based on what he said thus far three times in that 10th verse. Again, you need to speak the same thing. So he's getting a little further into it. You also find, as we look at the material, this quote, which I think is helpful. An old believer said, I've always maintained that one should deliver criticism gently and little by little. Here Paul does just this when he is about to embark on a subject full of perils, which could tear up the church from her foundations. He uses gentle language. Jesus did that as well. I had a teacher one time say that Jesus was kind. He was gentle. Every opportunity, he could be kind and gentle. And I think that's a good way to live. If we are able to be kind and gentle as we deal with people, whether they are young or old, use the gentlest language that we can, and when harshness is required, then that kind of language is required. Anything that you want to add or ask before we look at the third expression, unity? Okay, moving down now to the end of verse 10, we've got the third expression. Paul says, I want you to be joined together. But he says, I not only want you to be joined together, I want you to be joined together how? I want you to be perfectly joined. Anybody ever have something that was not perfectly joinable? Yeah, I mean, this is supposed to go in there, and it really doesn't fit. I mean, it's supposed to, so what do you have to do? We're going to have to get out the motivator, right? You know, we may have to use a little force, bump it a couple times with the fist, or maybe we'll actually have to get out a hand. That is expressed with the perfect tense. So people will sometimes say, well, yeah, you know, I can talk to him now. But that's not what Paul's talking about. I want you to be perfectly joined. And I want you to be in that relationship as far as an ongoing relationship. Don't want you to just tolerate the person. Don't want you to just be able to, you know, be civil to them on an occasion or two. But this is something that I want on a regular basis. One source in describing that word says that the term has a basic sense, meaning restore condition, to make an object fit for its purpose, prepare it, and adapt it to its usage, hence to adjust and perfect. Maybe this is not the best illustration, but when you think about someone who's maybe making a cake for a wedding, and they're working on it, and it looks like it's about 90% right, but they're thinking, I've never made a wedding cake. But, you know, they get the icing on there, and they write it on there, and they're thinking, you know, the curly Q is just not quite right. So what do I need to do? Yeah. And again, how you do that, whether you remove it or just plaster over it, I don't know exactly how that works. Just Google it. But anyway, you know, if we're going to have a wedding cake that's going to look good, we're going to have to fix that. We're going to have to adjust that. And we're going to have to make it right. And that's what Paul says in the church. You want to go ahead and have a relationship which is good with people. You want that to be fixed. And sometimes there are adjustments that need to be done. That same word is used to describe the fixing of the nets. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 21. Now, in our society, and there are a lot of jokes about this, and it does happen. You see it with vehicles sometimes. Here's the guy, his bumper comes off, so he doesn't really want to fix it. So what does he do so he doesn't get a ticket? Yeah. Duct tape comes to mind, right? Or we'll get some bungee cords and we'll just kind of wrap that, or we get the chain and it works, right? Gets him down the road, it doesn't fall off and doesn't get the ticket. But Paul is saying, don't bungee cord it. Don't use the duct tape. You go out and you fix it right. So, anybody ever have a vehicle that they didn't fix right? Anybody ever had that situation? What was your problem?
Well, mine was just a paint job.
Yeah, that was mine as well. I asked them, I said, blend, oh sure, yeah, no problem. And you're thinking, I've now got a two-tone car. Tim, did you want to contribute?
Well, similar to that.
Okay.
Before I started doing my own painting, I had a couple of tete-a-tetes with body shops. They, insurance companies say you got a damaged front fender. They're only going to get paid to fix that fender. And if the paint doesn't match the door that's right next to the fender, they don't care. But then, like you said, you stand 10 feet back from them, you go, wow, it's a different color. But they don't care?
No.
And you either got to learn to fix it yourself or drive it around like that.
Yeah, or a trim piece. I mean, it's got a certain ridge or it's lacking a ridge. And, well, it's a trim piece. It fits in there and it's about the same size, but, you know, color's off a little bit or the design is not quite right. If you want your car fixed and have it resemble what it looked like before it was wrecked. I mean, you have those kinds of things. The word is used in some other interesting ways as well. One source used it in this way, outside the New Testament. It described a master of a house offering a room to a guest after it had been made ready. It described a woman assembling fabric and finishing a garment so it was ready to wear. It was even used of meals. When food had been prepared, the lady of the house said it was ready. So, again, the idea there is coming together, having something complete. Another illustration, which for me is, I think, especially useful, is it was used in the medical field to talk about broken bones. If you have a broken bone and they say, we're going to set the bone, if that's you that they're working on, how do you want that bone set? Yes. You want it set perfectly. You want it so it heals in a way where it is as good as before. You've probably had, hopefully you haven't had this experience personally, but you've probably talked with some people who say they set the bone, and years later, what do they say? You know, well, my arm is kind of like this, because when they set it, he set it wrong, and it healed wrong. Well, that's bad, and that's not what we want in the church. We don't want, you know, dislocated members, so to speak. All right, anything you want to add or ask before we make a couple of the points? Steve?
I kind of compare this to the military.
Yeah.
You have recruits come in, they take an oath, they go through training, and their training is to become one unit. Same mind,
yeah.
same goal, same outcome.
Yeah, and I imagine that there were a lot of sermons that were used and preached as far as the military. I mean, because you can see these guys are on the mission out there. I mean, they've all camped in the same place. They've all got the same commitment. They're all following the same commander. They all take orders. And even for the people who had never served, I mean, that made sense because you saw the military. In our particular congregation and area, we really don't see that too much. I mean, you can see sometimes the National Guard, but the Romans didn't kid around with that stuff. And I mean, everybody knew exactly how it worked, and I think that helps account for a lot of the soldier imagery. But you can't have recruits going off in six different directions. Somebody saying, well, I think I'm just going to go absent without leave, and somebody else saying, I really don't like the routine for the day, I'm going to go my own way. Somebody else says, well, I'm going to go to bed early, I'm going to, get up late, those kinds of things. It just doesn't work. You all have to fall in line. And the church is an organization which needs to function in the same way, and when that doesn't happen, God has some procedures. So yes, the military imagery is very, very important. Okay. Let's take a look at a couple of the things here. Let's think about what I mentioned earlier, going back to some information as far as denominational groups. When you think about some of the different beliefs, how substantial are they? I think that's an important point to make, because when we think about the different religious groups that fall under the, quote, Christian heading, are they minor or are they major?
Major.
All right. You're thinking about the different, quote, unquote, Christian churches out there, the different denominations. As you start looking and the different beliefs, are they in the major category as far as differences, or are they pretty minor as far as differences?
Well,
yes, all of it. If we focus on the major differences, what would they be?
Requirement for salvation.
All right. I mean, you would think that's pretty important, right? If you're going to be in a relationship with God, if you're going to be a child of God, you would expect that God would have given some kind of plan. But when you look at 10 or so different variations of the plan, something is wrong. Either God messed up, or some people have misunderstood, or some people are not teaching the truth, knowingly or unknowingly, about the plan. But that would be the beginning point. There's got to be a certain way to God. And I mean, it would be like telling you that there are, there's a one-lane road, that goes from point A to point B. And someone says, well, there are 10 different roads to that spot. That is a lie. Now, you might try to go off-road, but remember what Jesus said in John chapter 10. If you try to come up some other way, then what? You are a thief and you are a robber. So if he says that there is one way to get from place A, sin, to salvation, then guess what? There are how many roads? There is only one. And you either follow that road or you try to off-road and you wreck. All right, so sin, salvation, what else as far as major differences?
Who is Jesus?
All right, again, you would think that people would be unified on that. Jesus, who is he? Yet you find that that is something that's disputed. You would find that, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they would say that he is a God. You would find, and this was especially true in the first century, they would say that Jesus is simply a power. There would be some other people who would say he was a prophet. The Islam faith would make that acknowledgement. So different ideas about Jesus. What else?
What about baptism?
All right. Certainly when you think about baptism, who is a candidate for baptism? There would be some people who would say infants can be baptized. Other people would affirm that it's only for adults. Is it to join the church? Is it to become a Christian? A lot of different questions about that. Does baptism allow us to get into Christ? Is that the final step? Or are we in Christ and then baptized? So that's a big one.
I'm thinking of worship with women preachers, with how often they take communion, music instruments.
All right.
Is it different?
Yeah. The things relative to worship. Church leadership. One of the identifying characteristics of the New Testament church is how to worship. What day? I mean, there are people who do not agree on the day. And you're asking, if you can't agree on the Lord and you can't agree on the day, how do you expect to agree on other stuff? You would think that, I mean, it would be like saying, if we have a job, we can't agree on whether we need to come to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. That would be absolutely, absolute idiocy. That would just make no sense whatsoever. You would expect that, all right, if we're going to get the job, it's going to be at this location, these are going to be the hours, this is going to be the job, and yet people really make God look bad when they say that we can't come to an understanding on those things. What about heaven and hell? Are there people who think that heaven is going to be on this earth? There are the people who teach that this earth is going to be destroyed. So a lot of those differences. You've got, and moral issues. I mean, especially when you start looking at today. Is it one man, one woman? Or is it Adam and Steve? I mean, it's just unbelievable as far as things that people try to teach and things that people try to deny. Anything that you want to add or ask as far as that part of the discussion? Okay, let's go down a little bit more. We have, as far as what was said a little bit earlier, as far as Brian, there's some people who think that religious division is good. Anybody ever find somebody who believes that? Well, there are people out there who do have that belief because you can find a church that works for you. You go out and you ask, or maybe you go out and start your own. And then there will be at least some group that appeals to you. But when we look at the Bible, for example, 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 10, we read about doctrine. And the Bible there says that God requires sound doctrine. He requires healthy doctrine. And you also find that that sound doctrine in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 3 is joined with godliness. A lot of people, they have doctrine. It's not sound, and it's certainly not godly because it's not consistent with the truth. Now, when it comes to the truth, how much do we need to accept? All right. What happens if some of that truth is not popular? Well, I mean, that's unfortunate, but that doesn't change the truth. What happens if some of that truth is difficult, perhaps, to follow in the world in which we live? Again, it doesn't matter. God says this is the system that I've given, and this is what we need to hold to. Hold to the pattern, 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 13. Jesus talked about that in Mark chapter 7, verses 6 through 9. There were some people who didn't do that. They held to the doctrines, the teachings of men, and Jesus said, if you are a plant, and he wasn't talking about tomatoes, if you are a plant that the Father has not planted, you are going to be rooted up. So, rebuke is necessary as far as false doctrine, and everybody is bound to do that. Now, some people have seen that, and they have said, well, okay, yeah, we still don't think that we can have unity. So we have devised a way for us to be together. This is not as common as it used to be, but we will have unity, but it's what? It's unity in diversity. What's unity in diversity?
Chaos.
Well, it is. But if they were to define that, they wouldn't define it as chaos. That would be our definition, and it would be a good definition. But their definition is what? Unity in diversity. All right, and that's kind of what we see with the LGBTQ movement right now. You know, you have your thing, and we have our thing, and they have their thing, and even though we're kind of different, what's true? We're still unified. We're still part of the alphabet soup, so to speak. And the world does that. But even when the world does that, how well does that work? It only works to some degree. Anybody notice that the T in the LGBTQ, some people are trying to get rid of the T, the trans folks. There is a movement for that. So they've reached the point where it's, we feel like you're infringing and you're damaging our movement, so to speak. So we want to drop the T off. So the unity and diversity movement, it has some serious issues. Gary, and then we'll see if Julie has some thoughts.
Just a little thing. I've seen some that put a plus after that, so that even includes more. But my real question is, since we're talking about unity versus denominations, for the folks that call themselves United Church of Christ, why do they use the word united? In what way do they call themselves united?
I think when you look, and again, every congregation may be a little distinct from others, but generally speaking, the group that is known as the United Church of Christ, if you were to rank a group as far as conservative or liberal, generally speaking, I think that you would put them in the ultra-liberal category. They tolerate a wide range of things. I have not specifically looked at the word united, but based on what I know as far as their teachings and the people that they appear to fellowship, I would think that the emphasis of united is that we have a broad reach. We're open to many different things. So no connection to us, even though there is a similar description.
I guess my question was, I just wanted to know the definition, your definition that you're using for diversity. I don't have problems with some diversity. I don't have problems with different color of skin or nationalities,
sure,
or, you know, even language. You know, I guess that's why I wanted
to. I would say diversity in doctrine, and if you want to narrow that down a little bit, diversity in specific doctrines.
Okay.
And then talking about that in the religious world. So, yes, because there is always going to be diversity. You have people, you know, gender is going to be different, age is going to be different, skills are going to be different. There is always going to be diversity in the church. Galatians chapter 3, Paul says, as far as those differences which don't matter, you're all one. Don't worry about those kinds of things. But there are... Yes.
Yeah. All right. I wanted to be sure.
Sherman?
You know that there are some churches that try to keep the unity by having two different kinds of services.
There is that too.
One is contemporary.
Yeah.
The other is more like what we do. So,
yeah,
how long will that last?
Yeah. Again, congregations, you know, it's difficult, and I think Jesus made that point as well. You're either with me or against me. Matthew chapter 12, about verse 30. It's very difficult to ride that fence and say we're going to accommodate this group and we're going to accommodate this group. At one point or another, one group is generally going to become stronger than the other, and the congregation is going to be pulled in one direction or another. And it might take some time, but eventually you'll see that one comes out on top and one doesn't.
What's kind of sad is there is unity and diversity in and of itself. Like, you talk about diversified, you have the Jews and the Gentiles. That's diversity. But there is unity because they have the same Savior. So it's, you know, there's obviously tons of problems with saying unity with diversity, but there is a point where you can start off with people, hey, we're unified in this book.
Yeah.
Let's start here.
Yeah, when we think about the unity and diversity movement, it's pretty much doctrine doesn't matter. Or at least we have core doctrines. There have been some efforts in the past to say, it's almost like a creed with some people. If you believe in points 1, 2, 3, 4, let's just say that there are 10 different items there. If you believe in all 10 points, then we will recognize you. And this could be true in the religious realm, it could be true in the secular realm. But we accept you as one of our brethren, we accept you as a member of the group in good standing. Now, if you reject one of those core tendencies, then that could be a problem, especially if you really go off the reservation and say, I believe that core teaching is wrong. But sometimes people say, well, you know, you're not going to let me in your group. But when you look at groups, every group has some core beliefs. And if you want to be a member in good standing with that group, then generally you need to subscribe to those beliefs if you really want to be a participating member. That it? Okay, let's make another point or two, and then we'll go down and take a look at verses 11 and 12. A lot of times there have been Christians who have had really good intentions, and they've been headed in the right direction as far as making this point, but they have gone at it in the wrong way. There have been preachers, there have been Bible class teachers, this has been brought up in Bible studies. People have come to 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and said denominations are wrong. Denominations are contrary to God's plan, and here is the proof, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10. Paul said, let there be no divisions among you, be of the same mind, be perfected in the same mind and same judgment. So three statements of unity, those three statements are right. God hates division. He wants Psalm 133 and verse 1. He wants brethren to dwell in unity. But this was written not to 1,000 different denominations. This was written to one congregation. This was written to the Corinthian church. This condemned the division within the Corinthian church. Denominations, as we know them today, did not yet exist. However, there are some principles in life. One of these principles is a logical principle. If the lesser is wrong, then guess what? If it's wrong to kill one person, if it's wrong to, you know, murder one person out there, let's revise that. If it's wrong to murder one pedestrian just because he was jaywalking, then guess what?
It's wrong for the next one.
Well, not only that. If it's wrong to murder one pedestrian who's jaywalking, then it's wrong to murder 10 or 5 or 1,000, how many ever there. So if the lesser is wrong, then the greater is wrong. And you have that same principle being used here in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10. If this division was wrong in a local congregation, then if you multiply this out and you have 2,000 or 10,000 different religious groups, then guess what's certainly true of all them? It's contrary to God's plan. It is wrong. You don't want to be part of that. Again, anything you want to add or ask, 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 10. Okay, let's see, we've gotten verses 11 and 12. Paul says, for it hath been signified unto me concerning you, my brethren, not the denominations, by them that are the household of Chloe, that there are contentions among you. Now this I mean, that each one of you saith, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ. Interesting point. Paul says, you are divided. It is severe. It's not the worst. But I still see you as who? You are still my brethren. That's interesting. He's writing by inspiration, so we would infer from that that God also saw these people as Christians. They were erring in some ways, but God had not cut them off. So Paul says, we're still spiritually related. I want to help you with some of the problems, but this division does need to be dealt with because it is a potentially explosive issue. Now Paul says, he's already kind of laid the foundation of verse 10. He says, you know, got some things here to think about. Want to kind of point you in this direction. And he said, I have some information about you, And where did my information come from? I got some insight from who? There was the...
Chloe.
All right, there was this household of Chloe. The ASV says signified. If you look at the King James translation, it is going to use the word declared. Outside the New Testament, that word was associated with official legal evidence. Paul has thus kind of put forward in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 9, saying, introduced this subject, thinking about division, and now he goes two steps in and says, I've got some proof. I've got some evidence. Now, if you tell a person, I've got some evidence that you've done something bad, chances are the person will respond with what question?
What is it?
Yeah. I mean, if it's the police or whoever it might be, what is it? Or how else might they word it? Yeah, that's going to be the other one. Who give me the source, right? I want to see it. I want to hear it. I want to know who gave you that information. And Paul doesn't make them ask. He says, I've got this information. All right. That could have come from the church messenger. I've been confirmed by that person, 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 17. Now, Paul did choose to identify the source of the information, didn't give him perhaps all the details that he could have, details probably surely that they didn't need, but I think there is a valuable lesson here. People, doesn't matter, could be the church today, it could be in the home, could be in the workplace, but do we live in a time where people like to make allegations without a name attached?
Yes.
Well, yes, especially in social media. And how does it usually happen? I have heard. I'm sure that's true. But my question to you is, that's about a step of where I am. But you've heard it from?
A reliable source.
Yeah, who? What's the source? So you might have this information, and maybe it's explosive, or maybe it's even tantalizing, whatever that might be, but I need some evidence. But oftentimes, that's not how it works. We've talked about this at different times as well. People will sometimes, to make their case more impressive when they're speaking with somebody, will use what kinds of key phrases? They want to get attention. They want to get something looked at. What do they say?
Reliable source.
Okay, a reliable source has told me. That's always a goodie. What else?
Lots of people think or know this.
Yes, lots of people know this. Well, the implication is everybody knows, or almost everybody knows, but you don't, or maybe don't. What else?
Whistleblower.
Huh?
It's a whistleblower.
All right, there is that, especially when you think about the government. Any others? There's still one good one that we haven't gotten to yet. Some people are...
Saying.
No, well, that's true, and that's true. That kind of gets the attention. What else, though? Some people are, how about upset? Some people are upset. Well, could that be true?
Yes.
All right. But if you're telling me that, you need to tell me a little bit more. You know, you're probably going to tell me what they're upset about, but who is it? Or it may not be some people are upset. What do they say?
A lot of people.
Okay. A lot of people will just increase it. Or they might say, everybody's upset. Well, I know that's not true. Why? Because chances are I'm not upset. So once they go that far, I could be, but chances are that they've overstated the case. So Paul gives us a very good model, and it's one that we should try to use as well. Now, when Paul expresses this, he uses a definite article, and the plural is also associated with that. Now, the slaves. Depending on how things were set up, you might have multiple people in the household. So birth control was a little different than what we have today, so you might have a large family, you know, 6 or 8 kids, and you could have multiple servants. So you could have perhaps at least a dozen people in a household, so there could have been several people that had given this report. And Paul did not act on the word of one person. Now, that can be enough, but oftentimes, if we really want things to go in a good way, it's better to have multiple people. So try to have all the facts before we make decisions, certainly before we make allegations or take actions. It's interesting, I think, to note as we look at the text that Paul had asked some questions. Let's just flip over for a second to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. That's a chapter that has a lot of questions relative to marriage. He says, now concerning the things whereof you wrote, and then he talks about it's good for a man not to touch a woman. But he says the Corinthians had written some things. But apparently nothing in their letter talked about what?
Sexual immorality.
No. Where are we at? 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 10 through 12. What's he talking about? He's talking about division. Isn't it interesting? He says, you had some questions about marriage. I got a letter from you. But nowhere in that letter was there information about this big problem. But I did get that information from the household of Chloe. And then if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 5, you've got another report about the congregation. Let's take a look at that. It is actually reported that there is fornication among you. Now, so we've got the report, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 1. We've got the report, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. I wonder a little bit, were there some other reports about the Corinthians that Paul just didn't reference? Where is, what's the old saying? If there is smoke, there is fire. And if you have these reports about Paul, again, possibly three separate reports, when you go back to the household of Chloe, there might have been some other claims as well. I can imagine the spiritual gifts, maybe that was reported. You have perhaps some information about the Lord's Supper being reported, some of the weird ideas about the resurrection. I mean, it would be interesting to know exactly what Paul had heard about the congregation. I mean, it would be fascinating. Well, you know, I heard this from him and I heard this from him, and it's like, this church is just falling apart. All right. That, are you thinking that he received multiple reports about different things and it's just kind of hitting those as he goes through?
Yeah.
I think that
was every the one report with all of it in there, and he was just, he had to start somewhere.
Yeah. Inspiration certainly could have helped him and guided him as far as what he wrote, but it's also possible that he took that information and then inspiration helped him weave this letter together where he highlighted that. But I do think that that is at least possible and maybe likely that everything that we're reading about was likely a problem at Corinth. And when you start counting up the stuff, I mean, it's at least one item per chapter, and there are 16 different chapters. I mean, you're talking about the collection in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. You're talking about love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. You're talking about the eating of idol meats in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 10. You're talking about whether or not preachers can be paid in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I mean, this is a long list. This is the kind, I mean, it's like having household projects. Somebody says, well, you know, we have some projects to do this year, and we've got 52 things in the list, one for each week. And it's like, wow, how are we going to get through all that? So this is a lengthy letter.
Well, it's obvious.